It is very good afternoon. It is the Niall Boylan podcast on this wonderful Wednesday afternoon. Now, we've a lot to get through today, and I want to focus on one thing in particular and something that's very special to me. Because I was born in a mother and baby home, I've had a huge interest in what has happened around that, the redress scheme, how the government have investigated it, of course, the apology that was given by Taoiseach not so long ago in relation to the survivors and the victims of the mother and baby home. But it all started way, way back. For many people out there who don't understand what the mother and baby homes were, they were homes essentially where women who were morally shamed into having their babies because they weren't married or didn't have a partner in these homes. The babies then were taken by the nuns who coerced them into giving these children up for adoption. Sometimes they signed, but I still suggest they were illegal adoptions because they were coerced. And those babies were taken by either Irish families or indeed in many cases American families. But one of the most shocking stories to come out of this, of course, was the Tuam babies, which is a story that has grabbed international attention all over the world. And I know many of our American listeners who may be listening on stream now, be it on Twitter and Facebook or either on our website. And we are going to send this all over the place to make sure American listeners get to see it because they have a huge interest in this particular story. But the shocking part of it, of course, is the Tuam babies with the Bond Secure nuns. And back in 2012, Catherine Corliss, who is a historian, discovered that almost 900 babies' bodies were mysteriously buried beneath the mother and baby homes. And Catherine Corliss joins me on the line. Good evening to you, Catherine, or good afternoon to you, sorry.
Hi, how are you? Good to join you.
Catherine, let's just go back in time a little bit and let's talk about, firstly, the history of this particular mother and baby home. 1925, it kind of changed ownership and they started to use it. Was it in and around that time, 1925, they started using it as a mother and baby home?
That's right. It was a workhouse since the famine times. And the building was there. It was on 7 acres of ground. The workhouses closed down in 1922 when Ireland became a free state. And then they decided to turn those workhouses into either mother and baby homes, county homes, or psychiatric hospitals. So the Tuam one was turned into a mother and baby home. And the Bond Secours arrived there in 1925. They were employed by the state to run the home. That's the way it happened now.
And the sort of individuals that were placed into this home, basically under the care of the Bond Secure nuns, obviously paid for by the state. What types of individuals? Were they troubled young women, or were they women who had just got pregnant out of wedlock? Because at that time, that was seen to be morally wrong. You were classed as an illegitimate child in those days if that happened. Were they the types of individuals that would have been in there?
Well, they were ordinary people, I would say. People, young girls, and some of them underage, unfortunately, that were raped by family, or, well, not family, I suppose, maybe relatives or neighbours or something like that. And they ended up in the home. Any woman who became pregnant, no matter what age, no matter who she was, what background, they were sent into the mother and baby homes, just as you declared, just out. It was the way Ireland was at the time. It was the iron fist of the church that decided that women who weren't married and who got pregnant, it was their fault. The men weren't blamed because the rule was that the men were tempted and they couldn't help themselves, which was an atrocious way to look at it. Mm-hmm. And many of those poor women were just raped. So they were sent in there, no matter what age or where they were from.
And as a historian, you became really interested in this story in around 2010, 2012. And what kind of made you think there was something more to this story than just the shame of women being put into these homes and having their babies put up for adoption? And we can see in the background there the mother and baby homes and the Tuam site. What gave you your first interest in this?
Well, to go back, Niall, I wouldn't class myself as a historian. I had an interest in local history, and that's important to say that because anyone could have done this. I am a housewife, minded children, minded the farm, tended to my garden, quite happy, and I just took up a local history course, which was quite good, ran for a year, and it gave me a huge interest in local history, and local means around my own area. So I started writing about my own area and the local journal, the Tuam local journal that delved into history, they liked my writing and they asked me to do an essay. So I said, why not the mother and baby home in Tuam? And that's where it all started, really. And from the local history course, I had got a lot of information. I had got the know-how, where to go, how to get information. And above all, the tutor we have, he said, He did say that, never give up, always keep trying. The answers are there if you keep trying. So that's where it started, really. And I asked the journal, would I cover the mother and baby home, because there was absolutely nothing written about it. So that's where I started out, quite naively, just writing a little bit of history.
And you noticed, but there was anomalies, because the anomalies were the death certificates for babies that had gone in or had been born in the mother and baby home, but seemingly didn't exist anymore. And from your own records, there was 798. That was the original figure, I think, that you came out with at the time, was 798. Is that figure still stand, or do you think it could be more than that, of babies who are either born, or maybe some of those babies were unborn, so to speak, anywhere between pre-birth and maybe 3 or 4 years of age, who were buried unceremoniously in, if we could describe it to people, I suppose, there was kind of these sewage tanks below the building. That's where they were kind of draped and buried there. I mean, that's 798 figures. Is that an accurate figure?
Oh, it's, well, there's 798 death certs of babies and children who died in the home. Now, that when I found that, I said, this is the prime record. We can't dispute this. The records are there. Each and every death cert for every child that died. And there could be quite a lot of stillbirths as well, but they wouldn't have been recorded anyway now. So mm-hmm. we can absolutely certify that there are 796 death certs, and that's what I worked on the whole time. There were 798 actually, but two of those I found them in the main Tomb graveyard, which is quite nearby, and they weren't illegitimate babies, you see. They were treated separately. They were buried with family, even though they had been. You see, the home covered catered for orphans as well, or maybe mothers that were very sick for a while, and they would be in there for a while. So they catered for those as well.
So these children who died, and we can only assume that they died to neglect, irresponsibility, malnutrition, disease, because they weren't tended to medically properly. I'm assuming these are the ways these children, these young children, would have died. But I'm trying to get a picture in my head of this, you know, this old, really old building with these nuns looking after the mothers who are having these children. And when they died, I have this vision of a nun taking the body, filling out the death cert, and bringing it to. If you could describe for our, you know, our viewers and listeners exactly where they brought these bodies and what they did with them.
Well, the home itself, it's a massive building. It was a kind of, almost you could say, like a H-block prison. And that was the shape of them. All the workhouses were the same. And by the time the nuns just moved in there and and tidied it up. And that's all that had to be done. Now, about 50 yards out the back of that home, there was a corner where there was a working sewage tank at the time of the workhouse. Now, you're talking about a massive sewage tank at the time, because it was to cater for all the workhouse, the hundreds of people that were in that workhouse. There was also underground Victorian, you could call them brick tunnels, leading to that sewage pit. So the evidence that I got is that the nuns obviously didn't carry them out. There was a lot of women in the home who stayed on because they had no family, and they stayed on as unpaid servants for their keep all those years. And it would have been those older women that would have done the dirty deeds, you could say, for the nuns. They would have carried out those little babies wrapped just in cloth and placed them in those chambers. And they employed one man in the home itself. That's all they needed to employ, because all the women who had to spend a year there with their babies, they had to pay back. That was their penance, to pay back for a year. Unpaid work, every kind of work you could think of. So that's who would have brought the babies there. And sometimes the one man that had employed the caretaker, he would have placed those babies in the chambers as well. And I have evidence that man would have had stated that many a prayer he would have said into the baby's ear before he placed them in the tunnels. So the nuns got those. That's how it worked.
And when we look back now, are there any of the individuals, including that man, including the Bon Secure nuns? I think the last time we spoke to you, I think there was about two of the original nuns were still alive, but both were in care homes at this stage, and probably, I think, one of them had dementia. Are they all passed away now, all the individuals, both from the council, from the state, and from the home?
Well, the nuns, definitely. As you said, I got the same information from the nuns that there's two of them still there, but they're not to be talked to, they're not to be spoken to, they're not to be they're not to be to go on any broadcast or anything because they're too old, they're too elderly, and one of them has dementia. But the other man, well, the caretaker, he died unfortunately some years back, and his John Cunningham was his name. No, he's well, that's well documented. That is his name, and I had been speaking to his grandson, who had carried the stories, and it was he who gave me that information. So
I mean, I suppose that a lot of them were doing what they were told to do, and the only answers we could ever get would be out of the nuns, who unfortunately are all gone now. Look, if they were in fit shape or in health, good health, I mean, nowadays there would be criminal charges for doing what they did and what they were responsible for, what we believe they were responsible for, which was certainly criminal activity.
It was covered up. It was hidden. I mean, the ordinary person passing in and out through that home, well, passing the home, nobody got in, really. It was surrounded by 10-foot-high walls, 7 acres, and very few people got in there, and nobody knew because... the nuns absolutely made sure of that. They would be met at the gate if anyone was calling, or they would, you know, even people who were delivering stuff to the home, they were met at the gate. So nobody really knew. The ordinary person wouldn't have known what went on in there.
Now, speaking of the ordinary person, we all didn't know. You knew about it, Catherine, as an amateur historian, and you had gone into great detail and great lengths to find out exactly what was happening. And if it wasn't
didn't
for...
I didn't find out, though, Niall. I didn't find out until I started my research. I had no idea that so many children were just thrown in there, and they were left there when the nuns left in 1961, even though I walked past that home every single day, going in and out of school and in and out to work. And we just didn't know. Country people wouldn't have heard anything at all about that. I was absolutely shocked when I got the number of babies who had died. And not, I thought, first of all, there were the stillbirths, but they were all the deaths, certs, saying what they died of, and their ages, and when they died. And I was absolutely horrified.
I mean, we got to know about it, of course, when the Daily Mail, I mean, I know on many occasions that Alison O'Reilly had tried to put the story out.
That's right, the Mail on Sunday, yes, broke the story.
And they broke the story, and then it became, of course, an international story. Enda Kenny in 2014, of course, Enda Kenny ordered a full investigation into it. So at that point, did you believe that you were being vindicated for the story? Because did you feel at one point, you know, up to 2014 when Enda Kenny ordered that particular investigation, did you feel like you were banging your head off a wall, that nobody was actually listening to something that was so incredible and so serious?
Well, I was banging my head up tomb walls, first of all, because, I mean, I knew this in 2012. I didn't know the amount that time. I only had about 200 death certs, and I decided then to really delve into this more. And as I said, it was a staggering discovery. And I brought it out in Tuam. I brought it to the Archbishop in Tuam. I brought it to the Bonscore nuns. Brought it to Galway County Council, who owned that site. Mm-hmm. And it was just sort of swept under the carpet again, or under the ground, you could say. And it was denied, and nobody wanted to know. There wasn't a will, and I was absolutely getting nowhere until the media took hold of it.
I remember covering the story in the very early days with Alison, when we spoke to Alison on the air, and I think I spoke to yourself at one point of the air. But, I mean, look, I have a whole timeline here, which is like about 20 pages thick, of everything that's happened between then and now. And most of it seems to be just kicking the can down the road. We had a Minister of Children, Catherine Zappone, at the time, of course. We've Roderick O'Gorman now as well. But, of course, the latest news now is that, you know, that Roderick O'Gorman now has appointed a new director who will oversee the excavation of the site and the former mother and baby home at Tuam. Now, are you pleased to hear that? Will you be able to step back a little bit, or do you find that you won't be able to, that you'll still have to supervise everything and make sure everything is being done right?
Well, after 10 years of begging and pleading, and with the government, writing to the church, I even wrote to the Pope, I wrote to that man in Dublin. Sorry, no, I just can't.
Roderick O'Gorman, sorry, yes.
No, the church, Archbishop, sorry, I can't think of his name at the moment.
Diarmaid Martin, is it?
Yes, absolutely, yes. And I wrote to the man above him, and above him. And got some replies, and nice replies, and replies I didn't want, God bless you, and all this.
Yeah.
But however, it was a struggle, I'm telling you. I went up to the door a few times, I spoke, and I pleaded, and all over the years, it was pleading, and keeping the media alerted, and keeping the story alive. It was a huge struggle, man. But I am happy that this director has finally been appointed.
And the new director, Daniel McSweeney, has been named as the director that will oversee the exhibition. And the so what are we looking for now? Or what are we trying to do? I mean, and by the way, I'm quite shocked that you had to plead and beg literally at the steps of the Dáil or go into the Oireachtas or whatever it happened to be. And it's shocking that we see a story in Ireland's history, such a dark story of, you know, over 900 babies who were buried unceremoniously in such a horrible, horrible way and allowed to die.
Because they're illegitimate, no absolutely other reason. And that's why I had to fight for them.
I mean, and don't get me wrong, many of those children may have died of incurable diseases. We accept that. But many of those children probably didn't have to die because they could have got medical attention or they could have been fed properly because many of them, we believe, died from malnutrition.
They were a nursing congregation and they would have known about hygiene. And you know, it was just pure neglect. If a baby got sick, it seems it was on to the next one. It wasn't worthwhile saving them.
About that just sounds horrendous. So you can only imagine what, I mean, they must have been heartless, absolutely heartless, because I don't know anybody who could allow a child to suffer and die. But so they must have been heartless people. I mean, to them, it was just an industry. It was a business. It was an industry that they were running.
Commodities, they looked upon them as commodities. They looked at them as sinful. Their mothers had committed a grievous sin, and therefore the babies were the offspring of that. And it was an awful, awful time in Ireland. And it's just from a religious congregation and from a church that didn't interfere and do something. That's what drove me all those years now. So nobody's speak for those babies. And I'm ensured, I wanted to ensure that they weren't forgotten about. And that is happening now. And that is why I am quite happy that a director has been appointed. And he is a good director. He has 15 years experience of war-torn countries about exhuming people who are missing. His experience in DNA testing, and it's just what we need. And I can't really take a back seat now. You asked me that, but
no, I don't think you can.
I am relieved, but
Catherine, I don't want you to take a back seat because I enjoy talking to you about it, because I think it's really important that people hear about it all the time. And I think it's important that we constantly keep talking about it.
That's what brought it where it is. People constantly aware and constantly asking the government what's happening with the children babies. And only for that, it would have died a very quick death again. So I am very grateful to all media who kept this going all those years. And it gave me hope as well when people would ring me up and ask me, will you do this, will you do that talk? I did everything I possibly could now, in between talking at universities. People were very kind. I did get a lot of awards, but the issue was this is keeping it out there for the June babies.
So, you did. You got a human rights award, and I know there's a book out as well in relation to
humanitarian award. And I got from the Red Cross as well, which is fantastic.
And you deserve it, by the way. And by the way, can I point out as well, you're one of the only people in Ireland ever to get a standing ovation on the national television show, the Late Late Show.
That was my very first time appearing on a live program, and I'm telling you, that week I was nervous. I was sick with nerves all that week. Only for my husband Aidan, he pointed out to me, you have to do this, it's going nationwide, it will make a difference, and that's the only reason. And then when I got the standing ovation, I was just shocked out of my mind. I didn't know where to look or where to turn and to run away. That's how I felt.
I sat and watched you that night, like most people in Ireland, because the ratings that particular night were huge because you were on it and everybody was very aware of this shocking story. But to see you getting that standing ovation, nobody in the history of the Late Late Show deserved it more than you did that particular night.
And as well as that, it showed me that people do care. There's people out there that do care and that do appreciate my work. And that would have spurred me on to keep going as well. All that helped, Niall. It was very, very difficult at times because I am an anxious person and I suffer from anxiety. But this was just too huge to let go of, and I just had to keep it. And it's great that it's come to this.
And of course, not only that, it got international attention as well. It was actually on CNN News. It was on everywhere. And I'm sure you've had calls from all over the world to talk to people in relation.
I had camera crews coming in the back door and then cameras waiting at the front door. But it was exhausting, Niall, but it was well worth it. It was what I needed.
Catherine, you are a true hero. And for the Irish people, for you to bring this story out and make us all aware. And by the way, the story of the Tuam babies didn't just make us aware of what happened in Tuam and the horrific situation in Tuam with those 900 babies, and not more than 900 babies, who died there unceremoniously, but it drew attention to the mother and baby homes as a whole. And now we're in a situation where Roderick O'Gorman is now addressing the redress scheme for the survivors, although again, once that's been delayed, we're going to be talking about that a little bit more in a few minutes. So it did draw attention myself, I was born in St. Patrick's Home on the Navan Road, to all the people who were born in Dunboyne, in Bessborough, and all the other homes all over the country. So it drew attention to the whole, Ireland's dirty secret.
It opened and uncovered an awful lot. And I think that's initially, when I started out, I think that's why they tried to stamp it before it got anywhere, because they obviously knew what was out there and what was waiting to explode. So thank goodness that it did explode. It also opened up people, for those who were adopted, it opened up that area where they are now allowed access to their files, full access. That law was passed, and that was another plus to come out of all this.
In relation to, you were referring obviously to the track and trace there, do you believe that in other homes, the largest home, of course, was St. Patrick's Home on the Navan Road. You had Bessborough, which was very big as well. Dunboyne, of course, was very big, and probably one of the more recent ones to close more recently. Do you believe that Tuam is unique in the sense that babies were allowed to die neglected and were buried on site? Or do you think it's possible that we'll probably never know, because St. Patrick's Home is long gone, there's a housing estate built there, and all there is to remember St. Patrick's Home is a little plaque on a wall. But do you think it's possible that there are other sites around Ireland similar to Tuam where babies are buried?
Well, absolutely. There is a story from Bessborough where I spoke to a man that he remembers as a child, and that should be looked into. He told me this story, and he's adamant that he himself and a pal were playing around the grounds of Bessborough home, and they saw a few people and a few nuns standing around a tank there, and they just came a bit closer. And what he describes what he saw as little green dolls all in a tank. And of course, when the nuns saw them, the lads were chased away, and that was the end of it. But I mean, little green dolls, I mean, that's to me, shows little skeletons that would have gone green. So, I mean, there is something in Vesper that needs to be investigated.
It was the same in Tuam originally. It was two young boys that found the original remains, if you go right back to the 1970s as well. Well, look, continued success with the great work you've been doing and raising attention for which is Ireland's dirty secrets and Ireland's really dark past. Do you think we've learned, by the way, going forward in Ireland? Do you think we've learned from the mistakes of the past and the way particularly we treat women? But do you think we've learned?
Well, I think it opened people's eyes. The church in particular, they're taking a different view now. And it will take time, but definitely it has helped. There's no doubt about that. It will give people and authorities and the church in particular an absolute different view of women. It has changed society.
Well, listen, I got to thank you very much indeed for joining us today, Catherine. I should really stand up and give you a standing ovation. Thank you very much indeed. And I'm sure we'll talk again very, very soon. There you go. Catherine Corliss, the historian who is responsible for the Tuam babies. And of course, many of us now know the story of the Tuam babies, which has gone worldwide.
The multi-award-winning Niall Boylan podcast. Listen live on Facebook, YouTube, and all the usual live stream services. To get in touch, just WhatsApp or text 085-100-2255. The Niall Boylan Podcast. They told me to shut up. Available for download from all your usual platforms.